Yeah, so as I said, I'm going to make several comments on this thing. So the comment number one is that what I just told you about this anomaly matching approach is really a modern manifestation of something very old, very well known, which is the Lipschitz-Matisse theorem. Right. So conventionally, the Lipschitz-Matisse theorem is saying that if I have such a ladder system, let's say I have spin one half chain with half integer spin per unit cell with translation symmetry, that my ground state cannot be too trivial. That's the standard statement of Lipschitz-Matisse. Here, cannot be too trivial specifically means that either some symmetry has to be spontaneously broken or the state has to be gapless. Right. So you know, in some sense, the anomaly approach is really just saying the restriction from the Lipschitz-Matisse theorem can really be thought of as a anomaly matching condition, right? And this instantly makes the Lipschitz-Matisse more powerful because Lipschitz-Matisse, on face value, only says the state cannot be trivial, but there are many ways a state can be non-trivial. But by thinking about the anomaly carefully, we know exactly in what sense the state should be non-trivial.
So, can I ask a question?
Yes.
I mean, I could take the spin half chain and map it also to bosons.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And then the Lipschitz-Matisse theorem would basically say the ground state wave function is nodeless. In a way. Like if it's a bosonic wave function, then it can have a zero, but it can't have a node.
Okay. Uh-huh.
So that to me would say it's a trivial state by that definition.
Yeah, I'm not. Okay. I'm not very familiar in terms of thinking about nodes. Yeah. Here by non-trivial, I mean that it has to be gapless. That's.
Okay. So you know, once it becomes a boson, then it automatically becomes gapless.
Yeah, it's essentially a superfluid. Yeah, I agree. Okay, so that's one comment, which is actually, if you think about it, quite amazing because the original Lipschitz-Matisse paper was even before the very first anomaly paper from field theories from ABJ. So it's kind of amazing. The second comment is that so what I showed you was that I put in what I call a translation symmetry flux, which is really just a fancy name of saying a unit cell, and then say that flux carries a half integer spin. You can do the opposite thing. You can put in a different flux. You can also put in an SO3 flux, which is actually more commonly done in the field. For the SO3, you know, think about an SO2 or U1 subgroup of it, and then think about a large gauge transform under that U1. So that's your SO3 flux. And if you do that through some, you know, you can manipulate your spin system and realize that this changes your lattice momentum. By pi. All right. So this also agrees with the general statement that anomaly means that certain flux carries certain charge. Here, you can also, you know, previously I showed you that a translation symmetry flux carries a non-trivial spin. Here, if you think about a spin flux, it carries a non-trivial charge under translation. So it works either way. Sorry, can I say it again? Sorry. When the gauge field is not dynamical. So when I say large gauge transformation, it's really just a unitary transform that that twist the SO3 spin. No. The thing about it, let's say, think about an SO2 subgroup of that SO3. So you can, in general, a SO3 rotation looks like as Z times some theta, uh-huh. right? So theta can depend on my sight index I.
Right.
Let me use X, right? And just choose theta so that, I don't know, theta is 2 pi over L times X. If you think about the continuum limit, this
so
is
that's
like
a twisted boundary condition. Maybe
it's not quite twisting. You are twisting it by 2 pi. So it's more like a large gauge transform, a flux insertion.
Yeah.
So
the gauge
transformation
blind.
It is exactly that. Right. So in fact, just essentially what you can see is that on the lattice, this one doesn't commute with translation. Well, because this thing is not translationally invariant, it has the explicit X dependence. But if you study its commutation relation with the translation operator, you realize that the way it doesn't commute with translation is such that this thing changes your momentum by pi.
Right. So you're imagining gate. You can imagine gauging the original, I don't know, SU2, and then considering, you're gauging the center of it or something like that. And you're considering a background.
You can gauge the whole SO3.
So you have a background field here with twines.
Yeah.
That's what you mean by gauging.
Yeah.
I see.
So. Yeah, here you can literally just act on your state with this unitary operator. Sorry, this act, as Z, of course, has an X depend. I mean, it's defined on each site. And S means whatever the generator of your S. For spin 1/2, it's literally just sigma Z over 2. Yeah, but if you have other representations, just whatever generator. Yes, it's feel like it's like a mutual chain. It's basically like a mutual chain Simon term. If flux of A induce charge of B, then flux of B should also induce charge of A. There's some feel like reciprocal relation there. Yeah. Okay. So that's a side comment. Another. Comment is that I think I can erase this one. So let me briefly tell you mathematically more precisely what exactly is being done here. Don't worry if you don't know the detail. I won't extensively use this anyway. So the third comment. So mathematically, exactly what are we doing? You have to forgive me for writing down some symbols that I will probably not going to define very carefully. So what the UV is, think of it, when we say to hoof the anomaly, you think of it as a topological action from a one dimension higher. Right? Think of your system that's really living on the boundary of a higher dimensional bulk. So here we have 1+1D system. So the anomaly inflow is really come from a three dimensional manifold. And for this system, the UV anomaly is an action that's I pi times, this object. So this is defined on a three manifold, and W2 of SO3 is the second Stiefel-Whitney class of if you imagine putting in a gauge field for the SO3 and for the translation symmetry, W2 is the second Stiefel-Whitney class, and the action reads as W2 of SO3 cup product with the translation symmetry gauge field. So mathematically, this is the object in the UV. And the object in the IR actually looks quite similar. So it's, again, a three-dimensional term. And remember, the IR symmetry is O3. right here. And in fact, the object to consider is the third Stifel-Whitney class of the O3 gauge field, or the O3 bundle, if you like. Okay. And now, if you're not familiar with these symbols, don't worry. It's something. It's some cohomology. The symmetry embedding, let me just remind you again, which is the key object we consider here. Remember, it's a group homomorphism from GUV to GIR. So what anomaly matching really means mathematically is that this homomorphism phi pulls back the IR anomaly to the UV anomaly. Okay. Now, I mean, again, if you're not familiar with these things, don't worry too much. But the crucial thing that I do want to get across is that this means that for a given pair or of UV and IR theories, especially for a given pair of UV anomaly and IR anomaly, this equation, let me call it equation star, becomes an algebraic equation. On the group homomorphism phi. And remember, phi, the meaning of phi is that it is on it describes possible realizations of the UV symmetry on IR. So now the game can be formulated as this. You give me a set of, say, your favorite UV system, let's say triangle lattice with spin half per unit cell, and you give me some IR theory you really like for whatever reason, some funny CFT, right? From those, in principle, you can extract the omega IR and omega UV, right? And then, in principle, you can go through a set of algebraic equations to tell if there is a way at all for you to realize or embed your microscopic symmetries like spin rotation or lattice symmetry in your IR theory, in your effective CFT or TQFT, right? By just solving this equation, right? And if there are solutions, what are they? Right? They are, you know, what are the legal solutions? Right? So in principle, it's all doable.
Question?
Yes.
Single spin variable phase.
Yes.
How do you address it in the ultraviolet, for example, for a general problem, depending on your field theory, you make a guess of possible topological.
Sorry, can you say? This is the mic. Yeah.
So in the ultraviolet.
Yes.
The Berry phase is very transparent because it's a Berry phase of extra spin.
Yes.
And when you go to UV,
sorry,
the topological.
You mean you go to IR or you go?
Sorry,
to...
when you go to IR.
Okay.
Sorry, the long wave limit.
Yeah.
So how do you find the topological term? Do you think about all possible topological terms?
Exactly. That's part of the reason why we go through all these things, because sometimes it's easy to keep track of exactly what's going on. Sometimes it's pretty damn hard.
Okay.
Right. For example, you know, there's the famous story about deconfined criticality. You know, figuring out the on a 2D square lattice Heisenberg model with spin half, the skirmion has some angular momentum. I mean, Hoding figured it out in the 80s or early 90s. That paper was pretty damn hard to read, right? Because the calculation was messy. Right. And there may be some cases where you just cannot do that. There's may not be any semi-classical limit where you can even do it. Right, so that's why those will be the situation where doing this thing will be more ideal.
Thank you.
Yeah. So that's the, so now I've defined the game, finally. Okay. yeah, so let me highlight this one. How am I doing on time? Okay, should be enough. And now, of course, if all I got is some reinterpretation of things well known in 1D with 6 or 7 different or even better methods, this would be pretty pointless. But the thing is, now we can move to 2+1 dimension where things are really out of control. But still, many interesting examples do exist, theoretically, numerically, experimentally. So we still like to know what's going on as much as we can. Right. So now, 2+1. The thing is that, as I said, the rule of game is you give me a lattice system, one can figure out the UV anomaly. Well, this has been done for all 2D lattices with the SO3 symmetry. So more specifically for GUV, that's SO3. So the choice of symmetry will be motivated by condensed matter systems. So typically, I want to think about SO3 or a subgroup of it. And time reversal, which is often important. And all the wallpaper groups. So meaning, in case you are not familiar with this word, which I was 1 year ago, it's all the 17 2D lattices, basically. For any symmetry like this, this UV anomaly has been listed in our recent paper, thanks to some heroic efforts from Liu Jun and Wei Chen. I don't know if he's here. And there are lots of them. So now, essentially, just give me a lattice, for example, a triangle or Kagame lattice with, for example, spin half or integer spin. You can just look at the table and then get the expression of the anomaly that takes some form of like this, right? But generally more complicated. But it doesn't matter how complicated they look, it's at the end of the day some algebraic equation you want to solve. So these are all manageable. And we also know a lot about various continuum field theories, especially their anomaly. Those things have been calculated by many people, by field theorists, also by us over the past decade or so. So let me highlight some results. So there are lots of results one can get. As you can imagine, you can play this game on any lattice with any of your favorite CFT, for example. So first of all, a sanity check, which is the standard, or I should say familiar, deconfined quantum critical points, for example, on square and honeycomb lattices. And the U1 Dirac spin liquids. And for the field theorists here, this really just means NF equal to 4 QED3. Okay. On the triangular and Kagame lattices, all work out. They all satisfy the non-trivial anomaly matching condition. This is nothing too exciting. It's really just a sanity check saying that we're not doing anything too crazy. What's more interesting is that there are many less standard states, many, let's say, previously unnoticed states. Yes. Compatibility with Dirac spinning on what?
On the bipartite lattices.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I should say that. The standard ones, they exist. They're fine. They're just not as stable because of the symmetry allowed relevant monopole perturbation. It turns out, funny enough, there are alternative Dirac spin liquids that can live on bipartite lattices like square and honeycomb. They don't look standard. In particular, the nearby magnetic orders are not the standard, like pi-pi magnetic orders, but there are some states, right? The anomalies do match. We don't have a parton construction of those yet. It will be extremely interesting to see if they are there. Yeah. So throughout, I'm just talking about kinematics. I haven't talked about dynamics, but of course you can put the dynamics in and ask all those questions. All right. So, I mean, there are a lot of new states that we haven't seen before using the standard parton approach. In fact, Eugene mentioned one example of a deconfined critical point on the honeycomb lattice, but not near the antiferromagnetic order, but near the ferromagnetic order. So we mentioned that yesterday. So let me mention some other examples here. So one example I find, is particularly amusing is this one. So first talk about a quote-unquote non-parton U1 Dirac spin liquid. So the continuum theory is, again, just a four-flavor QED. All right, so four Dirac fermions coupled to a dynamical U1 gauge field. And when I say four component, when I say four flavors, I mean four flavors of two component Dirac fermions. This looks not too weird. The special thing is that the four Dirac fermions form a spin 3/2 representation of the SO3 spin rotation symmetry. So remind you that spin 3/2 is a four-dimensional wrap. Okay. So this is something that doesn't have a weak coupling lattice regularization, because if you try to put some free fermion, some weakly coupled fermion on the lattice where the fermion transforms as spin 3/2 under the SO3, at least you get 8 Dirac fermions. There's a fermion doubling, right? You need 2 Dirac cones in your Brillouin zone, and each Dirac cone gives you 4 Dirac fermions, so that's 8. But this has only 4. So, yes?
Surface theory.
The entire point is this thing exists on its own. It doesn't require bulk. Yeah. So naively you say, okay, there's the fermion doubling problem. You can't have it. Well, it turns out the anomaly cancels out. So it's very tempting to say that this actually does exist. You just need some strong coupling mechanism to regularize it in the UV, right? It's actually very similar to the situation of trying to put a standard model on the lattice, right? At the free fermion level, it's pretty hard to do, but anomaly cancels out. So, at least a lot of us believe that it should be doable, right? All right. So so as I said, the if you do the anomaly calculation, the conclusion would be that this would be emergible on any integer spin lattice. Essentially, on any lattice where the anomaly vanishes. You can also have half integer on honeycomb, is OK. So 1/2. How do you implement the restriction?
Yeah.
What restriction?
That the four spins form spin data.
Oh, just, I mean.
I mean, if I just integrate, as you said, if I just integrate over all of them, I won't get that.
Why? Sorry. Maybe I didn't quite get your question. I mean.
So it's not just four massless supercomponent.
It is. I mean, okay, there's a U1 gauge view, but yeah. Otherwise, it is. Are you worrying about the regularization like polyvelar?
No, I was wondering why is it different from the NF equals 4 that you wrote down there.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, I should have said. In the standard states, people talk about in spin liquid community, there is NF equal to 4 QED, but the psi form a spin 1/2. Wrap of the SO3, and then you can have a weakly coupled lattice regularization, right? Just put two Dirac points in the momentum space, and each one has twofold degeneracy, so that gives you 4. Right. So the special thing about having spin 3/2 is that you only have one Dirac point in the momentum space, and that's hard to regularize. Yeah. With time reversal, yes. With time reversal symmetry. Okay. So this state is also interesting just from a condensed matter point of view, because just from a quantum magnetism point of view, because if you study its spectrum, the low energy excitations and so on, the funny thing is that the most relevant excitation, spin excitations, or spin fluctuations, if you like, they don't carry spin 1, they carry spin 2. So it's like spin pneumatic or spin quadrupolar fluctuation. In fact, this operator corresponds to the monopole operators in this QED3. If you study the monopole operator, the most relevant one, just by counting the zero modes, you'll see that they transform under spin 2 objects. So some.
Can I just ask a quick question?
Yes.
So in this, going back to the spin 3/2 representation, like four-dimensional gamma matrices generate the right down the generators.
Are they the gamma matrices?
Yeah,
I think so. Yeah.
So that was what was confusing me too. So when you put the dem slash, you don't really need psi I equals 1 to 4, but sort of the summation over the flavors is inside the dem slash, and you pick the.
No. This del slash is the same for all flavors. It's a U1 gauge field. Sorry. No. The gamma matrices are independent, right? These are two components. So the gamma matrices here act on the two component Dirac index, and then there are four flavor index, and this SO3 act on those four flavor index. That doesn't touch the Dirac index.
Oh.
Yeah. So sorry. Yeah, I misunderstood your question. Yeah. So this is an example of a critical spin quadrupolar liquid, if you like, or spin pneumatic liquid. And precisely because this one doesn't have a weakly coupled lattice regularization, if you try to get it through the standard parton mean field approach, where you split your spin into some fermions and you make a non-interacting fermion mean field ansatz and try to incorporate the gauge field, you won't get this. Right? You need some intrinsically strongly coupled mechanism to even put it on the lattice. But from all the other evidence, this one seems to be perfectly legal.
Sorry.
Yes.
Do you have an explicit construction for this state?
No. For reason I said, it's pretty hard. We don't. But presumably, if you really want to try, you may want to. You can probably try something like, you know, Xiaogang suggested. You know, have a slab of the. Of a 3+1D topological insulator, then realize this on both surfaces and try to gap out one surface. Because the anomaly cancels, it should be possible. But in detail, it's probably pretty hard.
Yeah. Oh, I know, but there could be anomalies that we are not aware of.
So that's the. That's the part I hide it from. The anomaly of this guy, we did a fairly careful calculation, it vanishes. So that's the the magic is the spin 3½. That's the key here. Yeah.
Yeah, so far actually you don't have an explicit construction from lattice yet.
No.
Okay. So may I ask why you say the most relevant spin excitation carries spin 2? I mean, why can't I just put
if you remember, so for this theory, the most relevant excitation, as suggested from either logon or numerics, are the monopoles. And there are six monopoles, right? You feel two of the four zero modes. And since the psis carry spin 3½, and they should combine anti-symmetrically. So if you do the algebra, you realize that 6 forms a 5+1 wrap of SO3. So the 5 is the spin 2.
Right, but if I just make a bound state between two psis,
that has higher scaling dimension.
Okay.
The monopole.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, right, okay.
All right, so that's the what we call a critical U1 Dirac spin quadrupolar liquid. How am I doing on time? It's over. Okay, so I'll conclude with a picture that I like a lot. Craig, can I? Oh, sorry. Okay, so. Yes. So let me just conclude here. What we mean by construct a face on the lattice, right? So I would say there are three era. Hopefully, there's the classic era where you try to do a mean field, right? It's what you do here, and then there's the modern era where we try to do mean field but in fancier basis, right? You split your physical operator into something fictitious, and you try to massage with it and come up with something, right? So that works, as I said, beautifully for things like quantum Hall effect, and even for spin liquid. And this approach was pioneered by a lot of people, including Bhaskaran sitting here. And I would say, okay, after doing this for a while, we gradually come up with examples where even this may not be the complete story, where we have to do something slightly more eccentric, and that I would say the postmodern era, where we don't worry about the Hamiltonian, we don't worry about explicit mean field construction, we just do anomaly matching. And with that, let me just end here, and thank you for your attention.
I just want to make a remark. The beauty depends on the beholder's eye.
Absolutely. You are free to choose which one you prefer.
I thought the anomaly was supposed to make it simpler. It got complicated.
Well,
I thought it was getting more minimalistic, but
it kind of is, right?
I thought that was less rigorous.
Of course, yeah. It is.
But my
Sorry. I should say unless you're doing exact solution, none of this is rigorous anyway. Right? Of course people are much more used to the people are very used to this thing. Nobody objects when you do this. A few people object when you do the second. Sorry about that. A few people object when you do the second, but most people will be fine with that by now. But if you think about the level of rigor, as I said, it's hard to define level of rigor on a real line. So, yeah.
Other questions?
So using this whole logic, are there things that you can say are forbidden from happening?
Oh yeah. Actually, if you randomly choose an IR theory with some randomly chosen group homomorphism, chances it's not going to match.
No, but I was wondering, can you give an example of something that you might have thought would happen, but then when you study it like this, doesn't happen because of this lack of matching?
Great. For example, on square lattice, you can ask how many different DQCPs could there be. DQCP as defined as an IR CFT with an emergent SO5 symmetry. Now you can imagine very many, many different ways to embed your UV symmetry, or spin rotation and lattice, into that SO5. Right? It's a lot of group homomorphism you can think about. And then you can say, okay, on the square lattice, spin 1/2, how many of those embeddings actually satisfy this anomaly condition?
So just when you say SO5, you're thinking SO5 with the Wester-Minowitten.
Oh yeah. But the Wester-Minowitten is more like a toy. Well, I'm just thinking about saying there is a CFT with SO5 symmetry and a specific anomaly of that SO5, right? We know that what that looks like, and it turns out there's only one embedding that's legal. Most of the embeddings you think about will be just illegal, for various reasons. So I should have emphasized this. There are many previously unnoticed states, but most random choice you pick up will be wrong. So these are highly non-trivial conditions that you have to satisfy. That algebraic equation actually gets pretty complicated as your symmetries become bigger, right? You have translation, rotation, reflection, all those things you have to take care of.
Sorry. Beautiful painting.
Can I ask again about, am I interrupting?
Yeah. Go ahead, Senga.
Yeah, so I'm very interested in the last state you wrote. So forgive me for asking again. So the symmetry is the SU2 spin, and also you have a reflection time inversal as well.
Okay. So this is the part I skipped over. So if you want this thing to be more or less stable, meaning you want to forbid things like monopole, perturbation, and so on, the thing you need is SO3 time inversal. Reflection will also work, I think, and some sort of lattice rotation. It doesn't matter if it's C2 or C3, either way will work. So as long as you have these three symmetries, this state, we think, can be, in principle, stable. Yeah.
Okay, and there's no anomaly with all these symmetries.
Right, all those, yeah, the anomalies all cancel with all those symmetries, yeah.
Okay, so is this also true for when size spins 7/2?
We did not check. I mean, that's a different theory, right? Because with 4 Dirac fermion, you can at most have 3/2. So you need more flavors to do that.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Yeah. It's a different calculation that, I don't know, Wei Chen, who's not here. Yeah, we don't know. But it can be calculated, certainly.
Okay, but so suppose I embed the spin 3/2 to a projective representation of SO5, is that still anomaly free or is it going to be problematic?
Oh, You mean if you have SP4 here implemented?
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, I'm not sure. Liu Jin, do you remember this? I mean, we know for SU4, it cannot be. There's real parity anomaly. SP4, I'm not entirely sure.
I believe so.
Right. Yeah, I would guess for SP4 there will be also a real parity anomaly, but I'm not entirely sure.
Okay. Thanks.
I just wanted to make a remark about these paintings, beautiful paintings. If you look at the history of Picasso's, the famous evolution, apparently he started as a realistic painter, and then he went to Van Gogh. He was dissatisfied. And he spent his whole lifetime on modern painting. So there is an evolution.
Exactly. I spent most of the time doing the second thing for a few years. But now I spend half of my time doing the third thing. So,
so something I missed. Why do you say it's SO3? That I'm looking at your fourth fermion case in 2 plus 1.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't I use SU4?
Right. That's the thing. If you insist to have a SU4 symmetry, this thing will have a true anomaly. That's the parity anomaly of the SU4.
Why does it have a parity anomaly? Because I have an even number of fermions. I thought I didn't have
But you only have one SU4 fundamental. It's one copy of SU4 fundamental.
Okay. And SO4 doesn't work either?
SO4, I need to check. Yeah, I'm not. So I think it doesn't. Wow, it's two copies of SO4.
So you're picking spin 3 halves because you want to cancel that parity anomaly.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. Yeah.
I'm a bit confused about the pullback equation.
Yeah.
So if I assume that I have a GUV equals 0, and also assume that the phi is trivial.
Yeah.
So does that mean that for any GIR, this equation holds?
Yeah.
So
actually,
that means that any JR can come from nowhere.
That is perfectly legal. It's just in practice, when you have that, chances your CFT will be pretty unstable, because there will be no microscopic symmetries to forbid you from adding all sorts of IR symmetry breaking perturbations.
But it can have any kind of anomaly I want.
The anomaly wise, that's perfectly fine. Right, you can just have a trivial GUV with a trivial embedding.
Yeah.
Anomaly-wise, it's totally fine. It's just that then there's no microscopic reason to forbid all the IR symmetry breaking perturbations. So as long as any of them are relevant, your state is not stable. Right? So that's the only concern. Otherwise, it's perfectly fine. Yeah, it just means you probably need to fine tune a lot of stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to understand the difference between the left and the middle. So in the microscopic theory, I have four massless fermions.
Yeah.
My only requirement is that I need to cancel the parity anomaly.
Yeah.
Are you saying there's more than one way to do it?
Yeah. I mean, there are different ways to implement the symmetry. So the thing is, of course.
So it's not just pairwise cancellation.
It's not. That's the thing. Yeah.
So how do I realize that when I regularize the theory that I don't cancel it pairwise?
So
how should I put in my regularized theory so that I do not cancel the parity pairwise? I only cancel it when I put all.
Yeah. This one, I think you can. I mean, if you want, you can put in the eta invariance here, and then the point is, usually, let's say if it's SU4, you put in the eta invariance, you realize you can't cancel that with a legal Chern-Simons term.
Yeah.
Here, if you put in the eta invariance, but with the SO3 gauge field, then you realize that you can actually cancel it with a properly quantized Chern-Simons term. Yeah, it's very similar to your game of doing it with charge 2 fermion.
So I have to cancel it with the charged four of them. If I cancel with charge 2, it will be different, right?
It will be different. But yeah, if you do the algebra carefully, for the spin 3 half, you know, you can take a U1 subgroup of that, right? That comes with charge 1 half, 3 half, minus 1 half, minus 3 half, and you do all those things, things will work out.
So
Sorry, I just have a basic question here.
Go ahead.
So suppose your infrared theory is just free Dirac fermions.
Suppose I what? With
the infrared theory is just free Dirac fermions.
Infrared with just free Dirac, okay.
So is there some interesting statements you can make about what kind of space groups can realize free Dirac fermions by this matching condition?
So, for example, it's something that can be worked out. Yeah, I mean, free Dirac fermions, we know the full parity anomaly of that, right? Mm-hmm. Essentially, the idea is, let's say you have some NF Dirac, free Dirac fermions, the microscopic symmetry is going to be something like O to NF, maybe with some time reversal and so on. So we know the anomaly of that. So then you just play this exactly the same game. It's implementable, but we haven't done that. So.
You could say that there are some space groups which can't realize certain number of free Dirac fermions just as a hopping model.
Oh, just with a hopping model?
Yeah, I'm just thinking a hopping model and free Dirac fermions.
I think that game has been played by the band topology community quite seriously. People like Ashwin, Andre Bernovic, they probably had a lot of papers on this. For the band theory, it's.
So can you say anything on the dynamics of this quadrupolar spin leg? Is it asymptotically free? What's the loop expansion?
It's NF equal to 4 QED, right? It's dynamically, it's just that. Well, the only catch is that when I said this will be, things like single monopole will be forbidden if you have time reversal and some latitude rotation, but two-fold monopole is not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We don't know if two-fold monopole is relevant for NF equal to 4. So I would say dynamically, this looks very similar to, let's say, U1 Dirac spin Legrand Kagame, which has a very similar situation. But otherwise,
it's,
yeah.
It's similar, but the loop expansion or something like that is not the same, right?
When you do loop expansion, you don't have this information, right? You just calculate, right?
I see.
Because to tell the difference between spin 3/2 of SO3 versus SU4, mm-hmm. you need some 4 fermion term, mm. right? Which, you know, when you do, it was treated as a renormalizable field theory, mm. it's not there.
Okay, yes. Yeah. I see, nice.
More questions? Okay, well, let's thank Jong Wang for two excellent talks.
Thanks.